Zeppelin Berlin. It fell east and west and north and south, and it hit both countries and companies, and hit them all at roughly the same time. We focused on the Berlin Wall's fall in the east because that was so dramatic and so palpable, a cement wall crumbling on the evening news. But in fact, similar, less palpable walls fell all over the world, and it is the fall of all those walls all over the world that made this era of globalization and integration possible. So this raises a very important question. What blew down the walls? Or, as my kids might ask, Daddy, where did globalization come from? I would begin my answer like this. The Cold War world was like a broad plain, crisscrossed and divided by fences, walls, ditches, and dead ends. It was impossible to go very far or very fast in that world without running into a Berlin Wall or an Iron Curtain or a Warsaw Pact or somebody's protective tariff or capital controls. And behind these fences and walls, countries could preserve their own unique forms of life, politics, economics, and culture. They could be in the First World, the Second World, or the Third World. They could have widely differing economic systems, a centrally planned communist economy, a welfare state economy, a socialist economy, or a free market economy. And they could maintain widely different political systems, anything from democracy to dictatorship, to enlightened authoritarianism, to monarchy, to totalitarianism. And differences could remain sharp, black and white even, because there were walls aplenty to protect them, and they were not easily penetrated. What blew away all these walls were three fundamental changes, changes in how we communicate, how we invest, and how we learn about the world. These changes were born and incubated during the Cold War and achieved a critical mass by the late 1980s, when they finally came together into a whirlwind strong enough to blow down all the walls of the Cold War system and enable the world to come together as a single, integrated, open plane. Today, that plane grows wider, faster, and more open every day as more walls get blown down and more countries get absorbed. And that's why today there is no more First World, Second World, or Third World. There's now just the fast world, the world of the wide open plain, and the slow world, the world of those who either fall by the wayside or choose to live away from the plain in some artificially walled-off valley of their own, because they find the fast world to be too fast, too scary, too homogenizing, or too demanding. Here's how it happened. The democratization of technology. Deputy U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers likes to tell the story that in 1988 he was working on Michael Dukakis' presidential campaign and was sent one day to Chicago to give a talk on behalf of Dukakis. While in Chicago, he was assigned a car by the Dukakis campaign staff that had, are you sitting down? A phone in it. I thought it was sufficiently neat to have a cell phone in my car in 1988, Summers recalled, that I used it to call my wife to tell her I was in a car with a phone. 9 years later, in 1997, Summers, on Treasury business, was visiting Ivory Coast in West Africa. As part of his official visit, he had to inaugurate an American-funded health project in a village upriver from the capital, Abidjan. The village, which was opening its first potable water well, could be reached only by dugout canoe. Summers, the big cheese from America, was made an honorary African chief by the villagers and decked out in African robes. But what he remembered most vividly was that on his way back from the village, as he stepped into the dugout canoe to go back downriver, an Ivory Coast official handed him a cell phone and said, Washington has a question for you. In 9 years, Summers went from thinking it was neat to have a phone in his car in Chicago to expecting to have a phone in his dugout canoe in Abidjan. Summers' phone adventures were made possible thanks to the first and most important change that was nurtured during the Cold War, the change in how we communicate with one another. I call this change the democratization of technology, and it is what is enabling more and more people with more and more home computers, modems, cellular phones, cable systems, and internet connections to reach farther and farther into more and more countries, faster and faster, deeper and deeper, cheaper and cheaper than ever before in history. There is a bank in the Washington, D.C. area, Valley Spring, which offers all sorts of internet and telephone banking services for its customers. The bank's advertising jingle neatly sums up the democratization of technology. It says, "Let us put a bank in your home." Thanks to the democratization of technology, we can all now have a bank in our homes, an office in our homes, a newspaper in our homes, a bookstore in our homes, a brokerage firm in our homes, a factory in our homes, an investment firm in our homes, a school in our homes. The democratization of technology is the result of several innovations that came together in the 1980s involving computerization, telecommunications, miniaturization, compression technology, and digitization. For instance, advances in microchip technology have resulted in computing power doubling roughly every 18 months over the past 30 years, while advances in compression technology mean that the amount of data that can be stored on a square inch of disk surface has increased by 60% every year since 1991. Meanwhile, the cost of that storage capacity has fallen from $5 a megabyte to 5 cents, making computing power stronger and more accessible every day. And innovations in telecommunications have steadily brought down the cost of a phone call and data transfers, while constantly increasing the speed, distance, and amounts of information that can be transmitted on a phone line, cable, or radio signal. Not only can you call to anywhere cheaply, you can call from anywhere cheaply, including from your laptop, your mountaintop, your airplane seat, or the top of Mount Everest. This is possible because innovations in miniaturization have steadily reduced the size and weight of computers, phones, and pagers. Now they can be taken to more and more far-flung places and afforded by people with less and less income. The July 1998 issue of Golf magazine reported that many golf courses are starting to install the Spider 9000 computer system in their golf carts, which allows cart riders to keep score electronically, measure yardages digitally, view videotaped hole previews, view video golf tips, order lunch, check stock prices, and watch TV commercials. The only thing it doesn't do is putt for you. All these innovations have reinforced and been reinforced by the revolution in digitization. Digitization is the wizardry by which we turn voices, sounds, movies, television signals, music, colors, pictures, words, documents, numbers, computing language, and any other form of data you can think of into computer bits, and then transfer them by telephone lines, satellites, and fiber optic cables around the world. Computer bits are the basic molecules of computing and are nothing more than different combinations of ones and zeros. Digitization involves reducing any sound, picture, number, or letters into a different code of ones and zeros and then transmitting them through telecommunications to another point where those ones and zeros are decoded for the receiver and reconstituted into something very close to the original. Nicholas Negroponte, author of Being Digital, has a vivid way of describing digitization. It is as if we suddenly have been able to make freeze-dried cappuccino, which is so good that by adding water it comes back to us as rich and aromatic as any freshly brewed in an Italian cafe. And as Negroponte also points out, we can now freeze-dry more things by turning them from atoms to bits, from sights and sounds to ones and zeros, and then send them more places more cheaply than ever before. Think of the process like this. The microchip and the computer are like a furnace that can convert all sorts of things made of atoms into bits. Satellites, phone lines, and fiber optic cable are like the pipes that run out of this furnace to the rest of the world. And as these pipes become more sophisticated, as they increase in bandwidth, which is the measure of how many ones and zeros your digital pipe can transfer in 1 second, we can use them to carry more and more of the atoms that our furnace has forged into bits. This process of digitization is so central to understanding this era of globalization and what makes it unique that it is worth stopping for a minute here and giving a real-life example of how it works. Consider a simple phone call. You pick up your phone in New York and dial a friend in Bangkok. When you speak into the mouthpiece of your phone, the pressure of the air from your breath hits a diaphragm in the phone's handset. The diaphragm then moves back and forth with the sound of your voice. That diaphragm is connected to a magnet, which is located next to a coil of electrical wire. As the diaphragm moves the magnetic field creates a current in the wire. The magnetic field fluctuates as your voice fluctuates, and therefore, the current in the wire fluctuates as your voice fluctuates. So now, we have the sound coming out of your mouth being converted into a fluctuating electric signal that goes up and down like a wave as the pitch of your voice changes. You've seen this if you have ever watched a voice being tracked on an oscilloscope. How do we turn that into bits that can be transmitted? Basically, what you do is imagine that these electrical waves are going up and down on a grid. You slice up each wave into tiny segments and measure the height of each slice, and then give it a number, expressed in zeros and ones. So, for instance, a height of 10 might be expressed as 11110000, and 11 expressed as 11111000, and so on. Each 1 and 0 is translated into an electrical impulse, which when strung together is known as a square wave. Unlike an analog voice wave, which goes up and down like the waves of an ocean and is more susceptible to minor distortions and variations in the transmission process, a square wave simply goes up for the ones and down for the zeros. It is much easier for the device receiving such a signal to read exactly what it is. All it has to ask is it up or down, as opposed to trying to read a wave? This is why digital copies are always so much sharper, and why anything that is sent as a string of ones and zeros from your mouth or fax or computer in New York will automatically come out as the same ones and zeros on the other end. But let's say you're a long talker and you are deep in conversation with your friend from Bangkok. So there are a lot of electronic impulses of ones and zeros that need to be transmitted. Thanks to the miracle of technology, these ones and zeros can be compressed. Basically, you have the computer say 8 times 1 and 8 times 0 instead of 11111111 and 000000000. Now we have your voice compressed down into a nice little package of bits. It's time to move them. We can do this in several ways. The simplest is by emitting a fluctuating current, where, in crude terms, it is 1 volt for ones and 2 volts for zeros. Or we can move them over a fiber optic cable, which works by emitting pulses of light. You flash a light on for ones and off for zeros. A compact disc is simply a flat platter of plastic coated with a layer of aluminum. They dig little holes in the platter for the ones and leave it flat for the zeros. All your CD player does is shine a little laser light on each track of the platter, read the ones and zeros, and turn them back into the same beautiful sounds they started out as. Or we can use radio waves, with a high sound for ones and a low sound for zeros. Whatever way we choose, chances are it will come out as a perfect copy every time. In the case of your phone call to Bangkok, your voice might have gotten converted to fiber optic light impulses. And then, when those impulses reached Bangkok and your friend's telephone receiver, they were turned back into sound waves by having a tiny device that translates each one and zero into a certain amount of voltage that hits the electric coil in the phone. When that coil gets hit, it creates a magnetic field that drives the magnet back and forth, which moves the diaphragm in the phone earpiece, which pushes the air, which turns back into your voice. Presto, Negroponte's perfect cappuccino every time. So when I say that the innovations in computerization, miniaturization, telecommunication, and digitization have democratized technology, what I mean is that they have made it possible for hundreds of millions of people around the world to get connected and exchange information. News, knowledge, money, family photos, financial trades, music or television shows, in ways and to a degree never witnessed before. In the old days, if you were living in New York and your child was living in Australia and had a new baby boy, he used to have to go out, get a camera, buy some Kodak film, take the baby pictures, have them developed, put them in an envelope, and send them by mail. If you were lucky, you got to see your first grandchild's cute face 10 days later. Not anymore. Now your kid can take those baby pictures with a digital camera, record them digitally on a 3.5-inch floppy disk, edit them digitally on his computer, and then transmit them digitally to you over the internet, all before the baby is 10 hours old. A former NBC News president, Lawrence Grossman, neatly sums up this democratization of technology. Printing, he says, made us all readers. Xeroxing made us all publishers. Television made us all viewers. Digitization makes us all broadcasters. Grossman's observation highlights another factor that makes this era of globalization different in both degree and kind from previous eras. Put simply, this democratization of technology globalizes production. Today, we can all be producers. Today's globalization isn't just about developing countries shipping raw materials to developed ones, letting them produce the finished goods, and then shipping them back. No, today, thanks to the democratization of technology, all sorts of countries have the opportunity to assemble the technologies, raw materials, and funding to be producers or subcontractors of highly complex finished products or services. And this becomes another subtle factor knitting the world more tightly together. I will discuss this in detail later. Suffice it to say for now, though, that this democratization of technology is how Thailand, in 15 years, went from being primarily a low-wage, rice-producing country to being the world's second-largest producer of pickup trucks, rivaling Detroit, and the fourth-largest maker of motorcycles. And this democratization of technology doesn't just apply to cars and scooters. As Tira Futrakal, a mutual fund manager in Bangkok, remarked to me once, "At our mutual fund, we didn't have to reinvent the wheel. We just had to import it. Some of the technology we bought, we got at 1/10 of what our parent firm, Bankers Trust, paid for it. Take, for instance, this automated voice response system, where investors call in, press number 1 to find out the asset value of the funds, press number 2 to get bid offers, press number 3 to sell. If you want to buy or redeem your mutual fund shares, you can do it all by telebanking now. And all of these bells and whistles come in much cheaper for us. We just waited for them to be developed outside. This is the real beauty of globalization. We are a local house with local knowledge, but now we have global technology and reach. What this democratization of technology means is that the potential for wealth creation becomes geographically dispersed, giving all kinds of previously disconnected people the chance to access and apply knowledge. In Kuala Lumpur, I met a Hong Kong Chinese woman who told me she once called the local Hong Kong number for Dell Computers technical assistance, and a customer service specialist speaking perfect Cantonese, the dialect in Hong Kong, answered. My Hong Kong friend remarked to the Dell specialist how heavy it was raining in the central district of Hong Kong that day, and she asked whether it was raining as heavily at the Dell office. The Dell specialist responded that it wasn't raining where she was at all, because she was thousands of miles away in Penang, Malaysia. That specialist was a Malaysian Chinese who was now able to get a good service job with Dell, while living in a relative backwater like Penang. The democratization of technology made that possible. India is rapidly becoming the back office for the world. The Economist reported on September 18, 1999, that Indian phone operators based in India are now working for GE Capital. On any given day, they might be calling from India to someone in Texas about why their credit card payments are late. I can't say I was particularly happy to learn, though, that these Indian operators assume Western names and reportedly pick up the twang of the region they cover. Swissair moved its entire accounting division, including computers, from high-wage Switzerland to low-wage India, to take advantage of lower labor costs for secretaries, programmers, and accountants. Thanks to digitization and networking, these jobs can be done anywhere that you have a high concentration of English-speaking high school and college graduates. This could be a huge boon for India, Pakistan, the Philippines, South Africa, and English-speaking communities all over the developing world. British Airways World Network Services, based in Mumbai, India, keeps track of the airline's frequent flyer miles. Selectronic, a telecomputing firm in Delhi, plucks doctors' dictation from a toll-free number in the United States, transcribes the recordings, and sends the results back as text to an American HMO. The Far Eastern Economic Review, September 2, 1999, reported that America Online now has 600 Filipino customer service reps in Manila who answer 10,000 to 12,000 technical and billing inquiries a day, mostly from the United States, which amounts to about 80% of AOL's customer email. The AOL subsidiary in the Philippines paid its college-educated workers in 1999 about $5.50 a day, the review reported, which is 35% more than the legal minimum wage, but roughly what an unskilled American worker would make in an hour. That is a meager wage, but it is a first step to bringing a whole new generation of educated Filipinos into the fast world. And you can bet the smartest ones will soon go off and start their own little tech companies, maybe POL, next to their AOL office. This rapidly expanding market for services and telecomputing could be the foundation of Asia's next boom. But to participate, countries such as Thailand, which got into the globalization game by offering cheap manufacturing, will now have to upgrade the education and skills level of its people in order to compete for the best telecomputing jobs and services. I was once musing with Jeff Baer, chief of network designs for Sun Microsystems, about where all this democratization of technology and the means of production might lead. The more Baer and I thought about all this, the more devilish our thoughts became. Now that we can provide all these previously non-tradable services through networks like the Internet, why not outsource your government, too? Asked Baer. Think about it. You could outsource your commando operations and border guard jobs to the Russians. You could have the Indians keep your country's books, and the Swiss run your customs service. You could have the Germans run your central bank. You could have Italians design all your shoes. You could have the British run your high schools. The Japanese could run your elementary schools and your trains. The democratization of finance. The democratization of technology certainly helped foster the second major change driving globalization, and that is the change in how we invest. I call this the democratization of finance. For much of the post-Cold War era, most large-scale domestic and international lending or underwriting was done by big commercial banks, investment banks, and insurance companies. These white shoe institutions always preferred lending to companies with proven track records and investment-grade ratings. This made bank lending very undemocratic. The old-line banks had a very limited notion of who was creditworthy, and if you were an upstart trying to get access to cash, often depended on whether you had an in at the bank or insurance company. These traditional institutions also tended to be run by slow-moving executives and decision-making committees who were risk-averse and not particularly swift at responding to changes in the marketplace. The democratization of finance actually began in the late 1960s with the emergence of the commercial paper market. These were bonds that corporations issued directly to the public in order to raise capital. The creation of this corporate bond market introduced some pluralism into the world of finance and took away the monopoly of the banks. This was followed in the 1970s by the securitization of home mortgages. Investment banks started approaching banks and home mortgage companies, buying up their whole portfolio of mortgages and then chopping them up into $1,000 bonds that you and I and my Aunt Bev could buy. We got a chance to earn a little more interest on a pretty secure investment, and the interest and principal on the bonds was paid out from the monthly cash flow from people paying off their home mortgages. Securitization opened the doors for all kinds of companies and investors who never had access to cash before to raise money. It was in the 1980s, though, that this democratization of finance really exploded. And the man who truly pushed out the last barriers was the brilliant, mercurial, but ultimately corrupt junk bond king, Michael Milken. Milken, a graduate of the Wharton School of Business and Finance at the University of Pennsylvania, got his start with the Drexel brokerage firm in Philadelphia in 1970. At the time, none of the big banks or investment houses cared to have much to do with selling low-rated junk bonds, which in those days were primarily blue-chip companies that had fallen from grace, or startups with little capital and no track record. Milken thought the major banks were stupid. He did his own calculations, studied some of the little-noticed academic research on the subject of junk bonds, and concluded the following. Companies that were not considered investment grade were being asked to pay interest rates 3 to 10 percentage points higher than the norm, if they could get any loans at all. But in fact, these companies went bankrupt only slightly more often than the top-rated blue-chip companies whose bonds offered much lower rates of return. Therefore, these so-called junk bonds actually offered a chance to make a lot more money without a lot more risk. And if you put a lot of different junk bonds together into a single fund, Even if a few of them defaulted, the total fund would still pay an average return 3 or 4 percentage points higher than the blue chips, with virtually no extra risk. As Businessweek put it in March 1995, Milken, armed with this insight, set about the arduous task of convincing a skeptical world that he'd discovered the investment equivalent of the free lunch. Since traditional banks and investment houses were skeptical and continued to shun this business, Milken quickly moved from trading those junk bonds that already existed from fallen grade A companies to underwriting a whole new market full of only junk players. Risky companies, fallen companies, new companies, entrepreneurs, and startups who could not get credit from the traditional banks. Even financial pirates who wanted to take over other companies but couldn't raise the cash to do it through conventional bank channels. Because of his contacts, Milken could also sell the junk bonds he issued to mutual funds, private investors, and pension funds, who realized that he was right about their providing higher returns for not much higher risks. This gave you, me, and my Aunt Bev a chance to buy a slice of these deals that had previously been off limits to the little guy. Many of these deals had convulsive impacts on the companies and workers involved. Nevertheless, it didn't take long for Milken's insight to be copied far and wide. Soon there was a flourishing junk bond, or high-yield, industry, offering the public a share of all sorts of firms and deals. A similar democratization of finance was happening internationally as well. For decades, big banks lent large amounts of money to foreign governments, states, and corporations, and then carried these loans on their books at par value. And that meant that if your bank lent a country or company $10 million, it showed up on its books as a $10 million loan to be repaid in full, whether or not this country or company had assets worth $10 million on that particular day. Because these loans were made primarily by banks and carried on their books, when a country like Mexico got into financial trouble as it did in 1982 by borrowing abroad to finance populist consumption at home, banks bore the brunt of the problem. Mexico's president could fly to New York City, call together the 20 leading banks holding Mexico's foreign debt, and say to them, essentially, "Gentlemen, we're broke. And you know what they say, if a man owes you $1,000, that's his problem. If a man owes you $10 million, that's your problem. Well, we're your problem. We can't pay our debts, so you're going to have to cut us some slack, renegotiate our loans, and extend us fresh credit." The bankers would nod their heads and work out some deal involving loan extensions, usually at even higher interest rates. What choice did they have? Mexico was their problem, and the U.S. bankers did not want to have to go back to their shareholders and say that this Mexican loan that they were carrying on their books as a $10 million asset was actually worth nothing. Better to just carry the Mexicans along. And because 20 banks managed most of the debt, they could get together and settle the whole thing in a single boardroom. John Page, who was then an economist working in the Latin American department of the World Bank, explained to me exactly how it worked. Page, who speaks Spanish, was down in Mexico in 1982, meeting with José Ángel Gurría, who was then the Director General of Public Credit in Mexico's Ministry of Finance. Gurría was legendary for his ability to get foreign bankers, from big bankers in New York to little bankers in West Texas, to extend loans to the Mexican government. I was in Gurría's office one day, and we were speaking Spanish, and the phone rang, Page recalled. It was the president of a small Texas bank whom Gurría had persuaded to take on some Mexican debt, and this guy was worried about reports that the Mexican economy was in trouble. Guria then switched from talking to me in Spanish to talking to this American banker in perfect colloquial English. He said, "Hey, Joe, good to hear from you. No, no, don't worry. Things are fine down here. Your money's perfectly safe. How's the family?" "Great. How's that daughter of yours? Is she still in school?" "Good talking to you. Call any time. Stay in touch." And then, without missing a beat, he hung up the phone and went right back to talking to me in Spanish. In 30 seconds, he had solved his problem with a key investor. But then a funny thing happened on the way to globalization. This international debt market got securitized, just like Milken's companies and friends. What this meant was that when Latin America got into another debt crisis in the late 1980s, then Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady tried a Milken-esque solution. In 1989, the Latin American debts of the major commercial banks were converted into U.S. government-backed bonds, and those bonds were then either held by the banks as assets or sold to the general public, to mutual funds and to pension funds, with higher-than-normal rates of interest. Suddenly, you and I and my Aunt Bev could buy a piece of Mexico's debt, Brazil's debt, or Argentina's debt, either directly or through our pension and mutual funds. And those bonds traded every day, with their value going up and down according to each country's economic performance. They didn't just sit on a bank's books at par value. Said Joel Korn, who headed Bank of America Brazil at the time, "What Brady did was really a revolution. Before him, the U.S. Treasury Department was simply pressing the U.S. banks and the IMF to keep throwing good money after bad at these Latin American countries. What Brady did was put together a market-based solution. Banks were given U.S. government guarantees to extend new loans to Latin America on condition that the countries made economic reforms. After extending these loans, the banks, instead of just carrying them on their books, chopped these loans up into U.S. government-backed bonds that were sold to the public. That brought thousands of new players into the game. Instead of a country just dealing with a committee of 20 major commercial banks, it suddenly found itself dealing with thousands of individual investors and mutual funds. This expanded the market, and it made it more liquid. But it also put a whole new kind of pressure on the countries. People were buying and selling their bonds every day, depending on how well they performed. This meant they were being graded on their performance every day. And a lot of the people doing the buying and grading were foreigners over whom Brazil, Mexico, or Argentina had no control. These bondholders were not like the banks, who, because they were already so exposed to these countries, felt they had to keep lending more money to protect their earlier loans. If a country didn't perform, the public bondholders would just sell that country's bonds, say goodbye, and put their money into the bonds of a country that did perform. So when Mexico got in trouble again for excessive spending in 1995, all sorts of big and little guys started selling their Mexican bonds, driving down their value. And Guria could not just call up 20 bankers and ask them to roll over the debt and cut them some slack. Mexico's debt had been democratized into too many hands. So this time, Mexico had to call up the U.S. Treasury and ask for help. And Uncle Sam would only give Mexico the money on very strict terms, and Mexico had to put up its oil reserves as collateral. The only way the U.S. government was going to bail out Mexico was on the condition that it ran its economy as well as New Mexico. Soon, lots of emerging economies started selling bonds the Brady way, often denominated in dollars. Today, there are 16 countries issuing Brady bonds worth roughly $150 billion. There is nothing new about governments issuing bonds to foreign holders. That has been around for many years. What is new is the degree to which these bonds are now widely dispersed to individuals, pension funds, and mutual funds. In the early part of this century, it was mostly the wealthy who took part in international bond deals. Now the retirement fund of Orange County, the school janitor, not to mention you and me and my Aunt Bev, can all play. This is because the democratization of lending coincided, in America, with the democratization of investing, thanks primarily to pension reform and the creation of personal 401k pension accounts. America is moving from a country in which companies guaranteed an employee's pension through a defined set of benefits to a country in which many companies now just guarantee a defined contribution, and the individual manages his or her own money and shifts it around according to where he or she can get the best return. And with people now living longer and wondering whether Social Security will be there when they want to retire, they are not only turning to these mutual funds and pension funds in an aggressive manner, but also managing them very aggressively for higher returns. Your parents probably had very little idea where or how their pension funds were invested. Now, many workers are offered a menu of funds with different kinds of returns and risks, and they move their money around like chips on a roulette table, rewarding the successful mutual funds and punishing the less successful. The online brokerage firm E-Trade ran a brilliant commercial that illustrated this point. The commercial opens with a man sitting in his convertible, his golf clubs poking out of the back seat. He is parked on the side of the road because a cop has just pulled him over. The cop walks up alongside his car, and the following conversation ensues. Cop. Evening. Convertible guy. I know, license and registration. Cop. Oh, Kirk Brewer, I've been wanting to talk to you. Convertible guy. Me? Cop. Well, you're the fund manager for my large cap mutual fund. Convertible guy, kind of proud. Oh. Yeah. Cop. So I noticed you made the top 10 best performing mutual funds. Convertible guy. Yeah. Cop. But not the top 5. Cop turns and looks at the golf clubs in the back seat. Convertible guy is looking a little nervous. Well, cop, let's put the clubs away and get back to the office. Then comes a voiceover that says, make your fund manager work harder. It's time for the E-Trade Mutual Fund Center. Finally, the camera pans back to the cop, who is last seen removing the golf clubs from the convertible guy's car and taking them away. The message is clear. Even the motorcycle cop knows where his pension is and moves it around among the best performers. This democratization of investing was also enhanced internationally when the system of fixed exchange rates and strict controls on international flows of capital, which was set up after World War II at Bretton Woods, came apart in the early 1970s. We forget now, but between the end of World War II and 1970, it was very difficult for a Japanese, Mexican, or European investor to buy stocks or bonds in America, and it was very difficult for an American to do so in their countries. But when the system of fixed exchange rates and capital controls came unstuck, developed countries gradually democratized their capital markets, opening them to any foreign traders who wanted to play, and then the developing countries followed suit. Soon all sorts of products were available. Mexican bonds, Lebanese bonds, Turkish bonds, Russian bonds, German bonds, French bonds. You could take your choice. And people did. The more individual investors could move their money in and out of these highly competitive global mutual funds, the more these fund managers would move their money between companies and countries, constantly demanding higher, more sustained returns. Each fund wanted to beat out the other funds to attract more money. Thanks to this democratization of finance, we have gone from a world in which a few bankers held the sovereign debts of a lot of countries to a world in which a lot of bankers held the sovereign debts of a lot of countries, and finally, to a world today in which many individuals, through pension funds and mutual funds, hold the sovereign debts of many countries. It is important to note that a lot of the junk bond money was also used to trigger a boom in company takeovers in America. Here again, the little guy who could never participate in such potentially lucrative deals could suddenly do so indirectly through his pension fund and mutual fund. This process of takeovers, though, put company managers under greater scrutiny, particularly if they underperformed. The process also helped to drive the streamlining of the American economy in the 1980s and prepare America for the era of globalization better and sooner than any other major country in the world. Many companies saw their efficiency improve as a result, although some had the life squeezed right out of them. One of the main reasons Japan has so many lagging domestic companies is that for years, finance there was not at all democratized. Japan's big banks dominated finance, so unknown upstarts had a much harder time raising cash, capital for hostile takeovers was not easily available, and banks pumped capital into companies that were affiliated with them, without regard to risk or competitiveness. Takeovers were also frowned upon for cultural reasons, and because so many bank boards and corporate boards were in bed with each other. Moreover, Japanese workers had little choice in or control over their pensions. They could not just shuffle their money around, so the pressure on local Japanese companies, mutual funds, and pension funds to perform to ever higher global standards was diminished. That is why Japan had a more genteel economy, but one that was much less efficient at Schumpeter's creative destruction. It's also why capital in Japan eventually became so misallocated that a huge bubble emerged at the end of the 1980s, and thousands of inefficient domestic firms were allowed to linger on life support. But that started to change by the year 2000, as Japan opened up its financial service sector, and American companies started pouring in, such as GE Capital. The foreign competitors forced Japanese banks to become more serious lenders, and this, in turn, forced Japanese companies to become more efficient producers. This has led to a more rational use of capital in Japan, and to more accessible capital for startups and new players. Money is no longer reserved for the good old boy networks. The GE Capital-owned finance company, Lake, started operating automated loan kiosks all over Japan in the late 1990s. You just walked up, showed your license or some other form of identification so that an instant credit check could be run on you, signed an automated loan contract, and got your loan within the hour. How's that for democratized finance? The democratization of information. John Burns was the New York Times bureau chief in New Delhi in the late 1990s. I happened to visit him in the summer of 1998 when the World Cup soccer matches were being played, and Burns was trying to follow the games on TV. One morning, Burns told me the following tale. "We have 4 satellite dishes on the roof of our house in New Delhi, which are costing the Times thousands of dollars a year. It's like we're running an uplink station here. Anyway, I got fed up because despite all these satellite dishes, I couldn't even get the Indian channel that televises the World Cup. It has something to do with weather interference and the satellites needing to be adjusted, and the man who is supposed to do it turns up intermittently. So I am complaining about all this over breakfast, and our cook, Abdul Tohid, who is 71 years old and the former shoeshine boy of the last British commander in India, says to me, 'I don't know what you're upset about. I get all the channels on my TV. You are wasting your time and money with your satellites. Come back to my quarters.' He and his wife live in a little compound in the back of our house. So I go back there, and his wife is listening to the BBC. I said to him, 'What's she doing? She doesn't speak English.' And he says to me, "She's learning." Then he hands me the television remote, and with increasing astonishment, I start at Channel 1 and go all the way to Channel 27. He had television stations from China, Pakistan, Australia, Italy, France, all these channels to choose from, and it was only costing him 150 rupees a month, $3.75. With all my satellite dishes, I only had 14 channels. He had just gotten some friend of his who had his own pirate cable system to run a cable along the telephone wires and into his house behind my house. It was all unofficial and illegal, but he now lives in the wired world and his wife is learning English. Meanwhile, I'm still struggling to get Indian television. Burns' story illustrates the third change that made globalization possible, the change in how we look at the world. I call this change the democratization of information. Thanks to satellite dishes, the internet, and television, we can now see through, hear through, and look through almost every conceivable wall. This breakthrough began with the globalization of television. Throughout much of the Cold War era, television and radio broadcasting was a restricted business because the spectrums and technologies available for transmission were limited. Governments either directly ran most television broadcasting or highly regulated it. This began to break down first in the United States with the advent of cable television, which could carry many more channels than could be broadcast over the air. Then in the 1980s, other versions of multi-channel television began to spread around the world, thanks largely to the falling cost of putting satellites into orbit. There is some irony in this. The Cold War drove both the Soviet Union and America to be constantly trying to put smaller and smaller, stronger and stronger, and cheaper satellites into space in order to spy on each other. That same technology, though, paved the way for transmitting television signals cheaply, which in turn helped to break down the walls of communism that much faster. At first, only big cable systems could afford to build the antennas to pull down those satellite signals. But thanks to the democratization of technology, and particularly miniaturization, soon millions of people around the world could pull down those signals on a pizza-sized satellite receiver dish mounted on their balconies. Suddenly, the restrictions on broadcasting were gone, and a huge new audience was created. Once digital television gets fully up and running, broadcasters will be able to offer not just 5 or 50 stations, but 500 channels. In addition, information is increasingly being democratized thanks to advances in compression technology, such as the digital video disc. DVDs are CDs, 5 inches wide, that can hold a full-length feature film with surround sound quality in multiple languages that you are able to play on a laptop or palm-held video player. I remember visiting the Persian Gulf back in the late 1970s, and customs agents used to rifle through people's luggage to make sure they were not bringing in any salacious or politically explosive videotapes. I would like to see them try to find a DVD in my suitcase. There was an explosion of DVD players all over China in the late 1990s, with every Hollywood movie being pirated and distributed to millions of Chinese homes. And increasingly, they won't have to wait for Hollywood. Inexpensive digital movie cameras and digital projectors, which operate without film, will make everyone a potential movie mogul. And not only will you be able to shoot your own digital movie at low cost, but with the internet, you will be able to distribute it yourself all around the world at low cost. As important as television and satellite dishes have been to democratizing information, the spread of the internet topped them all. The internet is the pinnacle of the democratization of information. No one owns the internet. It is totally decentralized. No one can turn it off. it can potentially reach into every home in the world, and many of its key advances were done by collaboration among individuals, many who have never met each other, who work together over the network, contributing their ideas for free. As central as the Internet is in our lives today, few people actually appreciate how it evolved. It's a fascinating story. The Internet was actually born as part of the U.S. reaction to the October 4, 1957 Soviet launch into space of the Sputnik satellite. Weighing only 184 pounds and roughly the size of a basketball, Sputnik's launch on board a Soviet rocket not only set in motion the space age, it actually set in motion the cyberspace age. At an October 9, 1957 news conference, President Dwight D. Eisenhower was asked by legendary reporter Merriman Smith the following. Russia has launched an Earth satellite. They also claim to have had a successful firing of an intercontinental ballistic missile, none of which this country has done. Now I ask you, sir, what are we going to do about it? What I decided to do about it was to launch a crash program to catch up with the Soviet Union. As part of that effort, he concluded that the U.S. government needed a single manager for all space and strategic missile research. Eisenhower eventually won approval from Congress to set up something called the Advanced Research Projects Agency, or ARPA. The space and missile research programs were eventually broken off and turned into NASA, and ARPA was left as the Pentagon's arm for promoting computer science research and information processing. Information processing was at the time a relatively new field. And as Steven Sigaller, author of Nerds 2.0.1, A Brief History of the Internet, the best book on this subject, points out, it was the Information Processing Techniques Office, an obscure division of ARPA, that would build the original Internet prototype and lay the foundations for what is now the Age of Networks. Its original concoction was first unveiled in 1969 and was called ARPANET, a crude private computer network linking the U.S. Defense Department with key university researchers and government labs. Funded by the Pentagon, ARPANET was designed to enable a handful of researchers to exchange ideas and data, and to save money by sharing costly computer time and equipment through a network system. With computing power scarce at the time, it was important that someone at a lab at UCLA be able to run a program on a machine in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and that researchers in both places be able to swap data. 30 years ago, on October 29, 1969, the inaugural message was sent over the first thin reed of what was to become the Internet, wrote the New York Times on October 12, 1999. It was nothing so portentous as "What hath God wrought?" the words christening the telegraph in 1844. It was just the simple word, "Login." There were only two nodes on what was then known as ARPANET. As the story has become enshrined in the folklore, a UCLA student named Charlie Klein tapped out the letters L and O, which were dutifully echoed back by a computer at the Stanford Research Institute, a center about 300 miles northwest in what was not yet Silicon Valley. It wasn't until 1972, though, that the Internet pioneers discovered email. Time-sharing computers in those days had a mail drop system inside them, where different people could have their own mailbox and leave messages for other people on that same computer. One day, according to Sigaller, Ray Tomlinson, who worked for the computer research firm Bolt, Baranek, and Newman, wrote a simple file transfer program to open a connection, send a file from one computer's mailbox system to another, and then confirm that the file had been transferred. Tomlinson later told Sigaller, "Once we had the ability to transfer a file from one machine to another, became fairly clear that one thing you could do was just write the file across the network and send mail to somebody else. I also happened to be working on one piece of software to be used to compose and send email, called Send Message. And it seemed like an interesting hack to tie those two together to use the file transfer program to send the mail to the other machine. So that's what I did, and it worked. Others heard about it. Other networks adopted it, and presto, email was born. It was also Tomlinson, writes Sigaller, who invented the use of the at sign in email to identify the email user with his or her institution. When the researchers involved in the early Internet discovered the virtues of email, its usage began to explode, as did the whole network, with more and more packets of data switching between universities, the federal government, companies, and research firms all the time. Other networks, smaller than ARPANET, also began to mushroom. But as Sigaller notes, they weren't able to inter-network. Each of them had their own protocols that defined how one network would organize communication among its nodes. This started to become a problem. You couldn't send packets of data from one university network to another. This problem eventually gave birth to the Internet, which was essentially created when researchers Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn created a cross-network protocol, a sort of universal one-size-fits-all computer lingo that allowed a packet of data to leave one network, travel, and then enter the gateway of another network. Sigaller explains that the solution was referred to in 1973 by its designers as the Internetworking of Networks, or for short, the Internet. The whole thing didn't get popularized, though, until 1990, when an English software engineer based in Geneva, Tim Berners-Lee, created a vehicle for making it easy and virtually cost-free to locate information all over this network of networks. This became known as the World Wide Web. According to Sigaller, at the time Berners-Lee embarked on the web project, there were about 800 different computer networks attached to the Internet, with about 160,000 computers attached to them, all with files and databases containing information that one might want to access. Technically, all these computers and databases were connected, but sorting through them all and plucking out what you wanted wasn't easy, because there was no centralized database, address book, or information manager. Berners-Lee's great innovation, as the New York Times once put it, was to design the software standards for addressing, linking, and transferring multimedia documents over the Internet. His key inventions were the Uniform Resource Locator, URL, a system of codes identifying every website and page of information, no matter where the computer servers that actually supported it were located, the Hypertext Transfer Protocol, HTTP, which provided an easy highway between every website and every user's computer, and finally, the Hypertext Markup Language, HTML, which set the basic standards for how a website should be organized and appear when called up on a computer screen. Together, the URL, HTTP, and HTML formed a system of hyperlinks, those underlined words, colored words, and graphic icons you see on a computer screen, which, when you click on them, instantly transport you to a related web page, even if it resides on a wholly different computer server in a wholly different country. That's why they called it a World Wide Web, because you could follow any strand out, around the world, and back. In the old days, this book might have had an Internet file devoted to it, with all sorts of biographical and other information. But to get at it, you would have had to negotiate a maze of different networks and codes. And even when you found it, it might not have been written in a program compatible with your computer, so you couldn't view it. Now, all you have to do is type in www.lexisandtheolivetree.com or click on a picture of my book on Amazon.com, and the World Wide Web will transport you right to the site. But for the Internet to really take off and become a mass tool for research, commerce, and communication, it needed three more inventions: the web browser, the search engine, and high-grade encryption technology, so that people would not hesitate to type their credit card numbers onto a website in order to do business. The browser was a piece of software that really helped to turn the Internet into a form of television. That is, it allowed everyone to display what was on their web address. So when you typed in a www address or clicked on a hyperlink, a whole screen full of words or multimedia graphics would appear before your eyes. This browser, combined with a search engine that could find key words and places, meant that even a small child could navigate through the millions of websites and pieces of information on the Internet and find what he or she was looking for, and then display it. Berners-Lee created a crude browser to make the World Wide Web work, but the pioneer commercial browser called Mosaic was put together by technologist Mark Andreessen in 1993. It was superseded a year later by a much more sophisticated product called Netscape Navigator. Netscape made browsing the web simple through colorful, interactive graphics that could find anything, anywhere in cyberspace, and display it on any computer. The rise of Netscape coincided with the U.S. Congress's decision to approve Internet commerce, and with a steep drop in the prices of both home computers and telephone calls. When mixed together, they produced an explosion of Internet usage and a democratization of information that has been revolutionary. Kevin Maney summarized well the Internet's democratizing impact when he wrote in USA Today, August 9, 1999, "As a world-changing invention, the net echoes many of the characteristics of the printing press. It brings a dramatic drop in the cost of creating, sending, and storing information while vastly increasing its availability. It breaks information monopolies. Think of all the medical information on the web, which until recently only doctors could access. Think of what you can find about cars and prices, cracking the information that had been guarded by car dealers. Millions of people now post their own web pages detailing the minutiae of their lives. The result is that never before in the history of the world have so many people been able to learn about so many other people's lives, products, and ideas. The next stage, the one that will characterize the early 21st century, is when everyone will have access to high-speed, broadband Internet communications right in their home or office, or handheld notepad or beeper. Broadband access means that there will be enough bandwidth so that your Internet connection will be always on, just like your television can be, and the speed with which information will be retrieved and the richness of the information that will be able to come up on your screen will be many, many times greater than what it is today. Such high-speed broadband connections will allow you to take part in a teleconference meeting from your laptop from anywhere on the road without any problem. It will allow you to simply and easily download movies, music, and videos, and it will make shopping via e-commerce a much more textured 3D experience. There was a wonderful commercial that was run in 1999 by the Internet company Quest. It showed a businessman, tired and dusty, checking into a motel in the middle of nowhere. He asks the bored-looking desk clerk whether they have room service and other amenities. She says yes. Then he asks her whether entertainment is available on his room television, and the clerk answers in a "What do you think, you idiot?" monotone. All rooms have every movie ever made in every language, any time, day or night. That is what high-speed, broadband internet access will make possible in every dusty, end-of-the-world motel. Put all of this democratization of information together, and what it means is that the days when governments could isolate their people from understanding what life was like beyond their borders, or even beyond their village, are over. Life outside can't be trashed and made to look worse than it is, and life inside can't be propagandized and made to look better than it is. Thanks to the democratization of information, we all increasingly know how each other lives, no matter how isolated you think a country might be. The minute you think you have devised a new, higher, thicker wall to hide behind, you discover that technology has found a way to lower it. And the minute you think you have drawn a new line in the sand to protect you, technology finds a way to erase it. Raul Valdez Vivo, the rector of the Cuban Communist Party's Nico López School for Advanced Studies outside Havana, put it so well in an interview with National Geographic, June 1999. He was asked about the difficulties Castro's Cuba faced in maintaining socialist principles, even as it was increasingly being forced to adopt capitalist means to survive. "Cuba is no longer an island," he mused. "There are no islands anymore. There is only one world." There is a story that in the 1980s, the Soviets once ran a picture in Pravda illustrating bread lines in America. Upon closer examination, it turned out that the picture was of a group of people in Manhattan waiting in line for Zabar's Bakery and Delicatessen to open on a Saturday morning. Don't try that trick today, not even in China, not with the internet around. What makes the internet so dangerous for police states is that they can't afford not to have it, because they will fall behind economically if they do. But if they have it, it means they simply can't control information the way they once did. And what's really scary about the internet for regimes such as China's is that it's interactive. It's alive. It's not just a radio where you listen passively. It's not just a television where you watch like a couch potato. On the internet, people are giving and taking, chatting and outreaching, uploading ideologies and downloading ideologies, buying and selling, and doing it all in a way that is virtually impossible to control. On December 4th, 1998, China put on trial a computer entrepreneur being hailed as the first cyber dissident who gave email addresses in China to a Chinese language internet magazine supporting democracy. The number one intermediate people's court in Shanghai conducted a closed trial for the entrepreneur, Lin Hai, on charges of subversion for having given the addresses of 30,000 Chinese computer users to VIP Reference, a journal that Chinese dissidents publish in the United States. The Chinese-born editor of VIP Reference told the Los Angeles Times January 4, 1999, "We are destined to destroy the Chinese system of censorship over the Internet. We believe that the Chinese people, like any people in the world, deserve the rights of knowledge and free expression." The title of this internet magazine, which is emailed to 250,000 mainland Chinese, is a jibe at China's leaders. The top officials of the Communist Party in China have a daily news summary prepared for their eyes only, made up of real news. It is called Reference News. As the LA Times noted, the editors of VIP Reference say their internet magazine is meant to bring real news to China's real VIPs, ordinary people. The same thing is happening in finance. An internet company formed in Chicago in 1998 called China Online uses stringers inside China to gather market and other news. They file the information to Chicago via the Internet, and China Online then beams it back into China, again via the Internet. Among the things that China Online offers as a daily service is the black market rate of the Chinese currency against the dollar in China's major cities. Its reporters go out into the market every day, check the rate with underground dealers, and then file it to Chicago. This is very useful data for anyone doing business in China, particularly for Chinese. It is something the Chinese government would never provide to its own people, let alone to the world. But Beijing is now powerless to stop it. In South Tehran, the poorest neighborhood of the Iranian capital, some families can afford a television and some can't. When I visited Tehran in 1997, I found that some of those in South Tehran who had televisions were setting up a few chairs and selling tickets when the most popular American television show came on each week, courtesy of a satellite. The most popular show was Baywatch, a Southern California fantasy in which all the women wear only bikinis and are 36-24-36. The Iranian government banned satellite dishes, so my Iranian friends just hid them under the laundry lines or under their satellite bushes, the plants they used to cover them up on their balconies. Thanks to the information revolution and the falling costs of communicating by phone, fax, the Internet, radio, television, and information appliances, no wall in the world is secure anymore. And when we all increasingly know how each other lives, it creates a whole new dynamic to world politics. When it comes to atrocities happening in some dark corner of the world, leaders today no longer have the option not to know, only not to act. And when it comes to some opportunities being enjoyed in some bright corner of the world, leaders no longer have the option to deny them to their people, only not to deliver them. That's why the more we learn how each other lives, the more leaders all have to promise the same things. And when they can't deliver, they have a problem, and it's only going to become more acute. In a few years, every citizen of the world will be able to comparison shop between his own country and his own government and the one next door. Today, no country can ever truly cut itself off from the global media or from external sources of information. Trends that start in one corner of the world are rapidly replicated thousands of miles away, notes Francis Fukuyama, author of The End of History and The Last Man. A country trying to opt out of the global economy by cutting itself off from external trade and capital flows will still have to deal with the fact that the expectations of its population are shaped by their awareness of living standards and cultural products emerging from the outside world. Sure, the president of a developing country can come to his people today and say, "Folks, we're going to stop moving into this globalization system. We are going to temporarily erect new tariff walls and impose controls again on foreign money flowing in and out. We will have less pain, less volatility in our economy, but also slower growth because we won't be able to tap savings from the rest of the world. So if you're not in the middle class yet, you may have to wait a bit." But when he does that, someone in a village outside the capital is eventually going to protest. "But, Mr. President, I've been watching Baywatch for 5 years. You mean no Baywatch for me? No Disney World? No bikinis?" Governments that want to avoid globalization not only have to prove that their alternative can still produce rising standards of living, but, and this is critically important, they also have to do it in an environment in which we all increasingly know how everyone else lives. Political scientists note that in the Cold War system, in the world of walls, leaders tended to invite their citizens to compare themselves to their fathers. They would say, "Are you doing better than your father? Yes? Okay, then shut up." But now, people don't compare themselves to their fathers. They have so much more information. Now they compare themselves to their neighbors everywhere, because they can track them all over the world on television, over satellites, on DVDs, and through the Internet. Now, they even look into the living rooms of their worst enemies, who used to reside behind the thickest walls of all, and measure themselves against them. My friend Laura Blumenfeld, a feature writer for the Washington Post, who has been traveling in the Middle East while researching a book on